Joshua chapter 10. This is a story told on many levels. It is, on the surface level, the story of the conquest by Joshua of the southerly part of the land of Canaan. On another level, it's the story of God's faithfulness to do what he promised he would do for Israel. That's to defeat the enemy ahead of Israel's army, thus assuring possession of the promised land by his covenant people. On yet another level, it demonstrates what happens when one is fully obedient to the Lord, when one does not fear the obstacles that the world throws in our way of attempting to carry out the Lord's commands, and that victory is always costly, and it's rarely a smooth road. Now, as we read Joshua, we must therefore observe what happens in the context of not only the actual history of Israel being retold, but also the much larger and more important never-changing God principles that are demonstrated in that process. Before we get back into the direct exegesis of Joshua, I would like to take just a moment to add another tidbit to the ongoing dialogue I've had with you since that first day, I guess several years ago really, that we began to study the Torah together. And this dialogue is about how to study the Bible, how to regard its words, how to extract meaning and principles from it. Now, this directly relates to Joshua, because it is important that we look at Joshua from the proper perspective if we're going to glean from it what's intended. It has become popular to study and debate the merits and the principles of the Bible as though it is a book of sayings or a book of proverbs from beginning to end. Proverbs are the ancient Hebrew equivalent of sound bites, of bumper stickers. Proverbs are truths told in short, very general, often greatly oversimplified terms, so they're easy to remember. Don't forget, the Bible was originally structured to be spoken, not written in red. So word memorization, that was central to its accurate transmission from generation to generation to generation. Now, in order to make my point today, I'm going to use this illustration. Proverbs are somewhat akin in their purpose and use to the individual bones of a human body, an adult having 206 of them. A single bone, taken alone and examined, is indeed valid, it has importance, but it is only truly useful and meaningful, its function and purpose is only brought to fruition when it's viewed as a united member of the entire body and it's connected in to its proper place. One single bone set aside and viewed in isolation is also not very indicative of the overall nature and substance of a human being, to which it's part, even though that single bone can give us some hints and some clues. Now, while an entire skeleton, all 206 bones in their proper place, gives us a real and discernible shape of a human being, yet even a skeleton by itself is not the full picture, nor can it even support life as it is. As in the dramatic vision of Ezekiel in the Valley of Dry Bones, by itself, skeletal bones form an inert, if you would, framework, and nothing more. It's not until we add the internal organs, a brain, ligaments, muscles, fibers, and flesh, and outer sensory organs, and then that supernatural breath of God, that we finally arrive with a complete and functioning person. Further, while a complete skeleton indeed gives us a general and a standard shape of a human, the devil, as they say, is in the details. I dare say that if all of us in this room were suddenly reduced to nothing but our skeletons, we would lose the ability to identify even our own spouses or children, because it is the millions of subtleties of what grows upon these bony frames that makes us recognizable to one another and operational for the purposes we were created. Now, just as I have metaphorically compared biblical proverbs to individual skeletal bones, so in Christian discussion and in debate, it is these individual phrases and verses plucked from our Bibles. Some have come regarded in some ways as proverbs, sayings that can be taken as is without more context, as complete, useful, and final thought. And while there certainly is truth in those individual scriptural phrases and verses, to try and draw too much of a conclusion from just one or two in isolation, or to try and regard a verse or a phrase as sufficient to stand alone as a doctrine, that is dangerous, and it can be very, very self-deceiving. Now, more to the point at hand, it is all too common in our Judeo-Christian struggles over theological principles that we like to play the never-ending game of my verse is better than your verse. Take any given subject, and usually we can find contradiction and enormous differences in the Bible if we essentially make a verse or two into a proverb and then hold it up against another one. Using my skeletal illustration, how useful is it for us to argue my finger bone is a much truer picture of what a human being looks like and how he functions than your toe bone? In fact, how much can we actually discern if we were to take an entire hand bone structure and try to extrapolate only from that what a full human skeleton looks like? Because I could just as easily grab an entire foot bone structure and argue that it better represents the human form. Which one would be right? The Lord was very wise and merciful in the way that he gave us his word of truth. He didn't show us one bone. Tell us that's all you need to know. Or that with this one bone, all the others aren't really needed to properly define who he is, who we are, and the relationship and plan he has for us. He also didn't throw the 206 bones in a pile and say, you figure it out how to put it together. And thankfully, he didn't give us a box full of internal organs, another box with our skin suit in it, a container full of ligaments and a bucket with our sensory organs and say, use your imagination. Rather, God built principle upon principle in a precise order, an order he fit together just so. And then he gave us examples of the meaning and the effect of those principles at work, how they operated, how they connected, how they combined with others of his principles in order to form a more complete picture. By means of divine inspiration in the stories of real people in real situations in the Bible, Jehovah told us what it was all working towards. He even gave us an example of the lifestyle we should lead while the Lord was unfolding his plan. He told us what pleased him, what didn't, what works, what doesn't work in his economy. If we want to actually understand the Bible, we must look at it as a whole, not a collection of pieces that can be connected in any number of ways, as though the Bible verses were Legos or Tinker Toys. We also cannot separate out a tiny piece or two and have it stand as representative of the whole. Nor can we intentionally throw away and ignore bits and pieces that, when looked at individually and not without regard to the whole, seem to be redundant or even contradict other bits and pieces. So I think we've come to a point after all this time of studying together that I want to say this to you in the strongest possible terms. Do not challenge one another based on one or two verses that you prefer. You so prefer to all the others that for you, it's the final word on any given subject. It is this mindset that has led to the concept of doctrinal base as opposed to scriptural-based Christianity. And the result is myriads of competing denominations. The Bible is not structured that way. It was never intended to be used that way. Even the extensive law of Moses that the Lord set out with a list of 613 negative and positive commands doesn't give us a full enough picture. So Moses gave Israel his Sermon on the Mount in Moab. And the Father gave us many examples in the form of stories and narratives that we could follow. In some cases, told we ought to avoid it. And he developed patterns so we could discern whether what we were thinking about what he was saying actually fit his intentions. There's no shortcuts to learning or discussing God's principles. And tossing isolated verses back and forth at one another in order to defend or uphold some doctrine we hold dear, that's just not useful. Rather, it is essential that once a person has become a believer, that he or she earnestly study God's word, beginning at the beginning, with the only preconceived notion being that it is the truth and it is inspired. It is vital that we assemble the whole truth of God in the order it was given, employing all the parts, all the pieces, discarding none of it, not even the ones we just don't know what to do with. Let's get back to Joshua now, and let's see both the history of Israel unfold and the playing out of God's principles unfold as they move from theory into practice. So open your Bibles to Joshua chapter 10. Joshua chapter 10. We're going to start at verse 15. So that'll be on page 252 if you have a complete Jewish Bible. 252, starting at verse 15. Joshua returned with all Israel to the camp at Gilgal. But those five kings fled and hid themselves in the cave at Makkedah. And it was reported to Joshua that the five kings had been found hiding in the cave at Makkedah. And Joshua said, "Roll big stones to the mouth of the cave, put men there to guard them. However, you don't wait, but keep chasing your enemies and attack those farthest in the rear. Don't allow them to return to their cities, because Adonai has handed them over to you." Now, after Joshua and the people of Israel had finished killing them off in a very great slaughter, till they had been destroyed, and the remaining remnant had entered the fortified cities, all the people returned safely to Joshua at the camp at Makkedah, and no one said a word against any of the people of Israel. Then Joshua said, "Open up the mouth of the cave and bring those five kings out of the cave to me." They did. They brought out the five kings to him, the kings of Jerusalem, Hebron, Yarmuth, Lachish, and Eglon. And after they had brought in the five kings to Joshua, he summoned all the men of Israel. And he said to the commanders of the soldiers who had gone with him, Come here and put your feet on the necks of these kings. They came and put their feet on their necks, and Joshua said to them, don't be afraid or confused. Be strong and bold, because this is what Adonai will do to all your enemies that you fight against. And with that, Joshua struck them and put them to death, hanging them on five trees, where they remained hanging until evening. At sunset, Joshua gave an order, and they lowered them from the trees and threw them into the cave where they had hidden themselves, then laid big stones at the mouth of the cave, and there they remain to this day. Joshua captured Makkedah that day, defeating it and its king by the sword. He completely destroyed them, everyone there. He left no one, and he did to the king of Makkedah what he had done to the king of Jericho. And Joshua went on from Makkedah, and all Israel went with him to Libnah, and he fought against Libnah. Adonai also handed it and its king over to Israel, and he defeated it with the sword, everyone there. He left no one, and he did to its king what he had done to the king of Jericho. Joshua went on from Libnah and all Israel with him to Lachish, and he pitched camp against it, and he fought against it, and Adonai handed it over to Israel. He captured it on the second day. He defeated it with the sword, everyone there, exactly as he'd done to Libnah. But then Horam, king of Gezer, came up to help Lachish, so Joshua attacked him and his people until he had no one left with him. And Joshua went on from Lachish and all Israel with him to Eglon, and he pitched camp against it and fought against it. They captured it that very day. He defeated it with the sword, completely destroying everyone there, exactly as he had done to Lachish. Joshua went up against Eglon and all Israel with him to Hebron, and they fought against it. They captured it, defeating it with the sword, including its king, its villages, and everyone there. He left no one, exactly as he'd done to Eglon, but he completely destroyed it and everyone there. Joshua turned back, and all Israel with him, to Debir. He fought against it. They captured it, its king, and all its villages, defeating them with the sword and utterly destroying everyone there. He left no one. He did to Debir and its king as he had done to Hebron and as he had done to Libnah and its king. So Joshua attacked all the land, the hills, the Negev, the Shephelah, and the mountain slopes, and all their kings. He left none, but he completely destroyed everything that breathed, as Adonai, the God of Israel, had ordered. Joshua attacked them from Kadesh Barnea to Gaza and all the land of Goshen as far as Gibeon. Joshua captured all these kings and their land all at the same time because Adonai, the God of Israel, fought on Israel's behalf. Then Joshua returned, all Israel with him, to the camp at Gilgal. Joshua and the Israelite army soundly defeated the southern Canaanite coalition forces. And the kings who headed up the defeated forces, of course, fled to try and save their own lives. Now, they stole away to a place called Makkedah, and they hid in a cave there. But they were soon found, and so Joshua was informed about it. Now, Joshua was currently with the troops and their families at the semi-permanent Israeli encampment at Gilgal. So he traveled southwest to Makkedah and there ordered the five kings to be sealed inside their hiding places using some large rocks to cover over the mouth of the cave. This jail would then be guarded by some soldiers until Joshua had finished off as many of the coalition army's troops as he could. Priority number one was to destroy the enemy armies. Dealing with the captured kings, that could wait. So basically Joshua's orders of verse 19 were for Israel's forces to move very rapidly to catch up with the various groups of surviving but fleeing enemy soldiers, and starting at the rear of their columns to just slaughter them. Now, Israel would have divided their forces into several groups as each of these five armies had an entirely different destination they were fleeing to. The hope was that by attacking the enemy in this way, it would be like eating your way up a stalk of celery. You start chomping at the bottom and work your way on up to the tip. Okay. In other words, Joshua didn't think that his various battalions of troops had the time to beat the five armies back to their fortified cities and then cut them off. Rather, Israel would start attacking at the rear just as soon as they caught up to them. and then move their way forward with the hope they would fight their way to the front of the column eventually, killing them all in the process before any particular army reached the security of their walled city. But we find out in verse 20 that while Israel got most of them, some of them still made it back to safety. Now, we don't really know how much time elapsed when the five-king coalition attacked Israel to when the fighting stopped, and if Joshua finally dealt with the five kings, it could have been several weeks, could have been more. Now, although the tone of the narrative makes it seem as though this all happened in just a couple of days, it's really only typical of the way the Hebrew and Old Testament biblical way records these kinds of things. Time wasn't important. Exactly what happened, what order it happened, wasn't always important. But when it was made clear. Back in verse 15, we're told that after the main battle at Gibeon, Joshua and all of his fighting men returned to their home base at Gilgal. So it's not like the Battle of Gibeon, just continued on with the pursuit of the now fractured and divided enemy forces. A wonderful God principle really is in play here. After their missteps at Ai and then making peace with Gibeon, Israel determined to obey the Lord and do it his way from now on. Thus, they handed a very swift defeat to the army of the five kings, and now their reward was not only a swift victory, but also they were ushered safely back to home and family. They returned to their camp where they had wholeness, safety, and health. Battle was not Israel's natural state that God intended for them. Shalom, peace, that was their natural state. Obedience brought them more quickly back to the goal of safety and security and peace, and this was a reward and gift from God. But we as modern-day believers have to learn a hard lesson from this. A lesson that Joshua and his fighting men learned, happily, sooner than later. When God says that he has already turned the enemy over to them, it does not mean that Israel can just sit in comfort, at ease in their camp, pray, praise the Lord, and then just wait for the enemy to surrender. It was Israel's job to go and claim that victory that the Lord had already given to them. But to claim it, in this case, meant they had a battle for it. To claim it meant lives had to be risked. Injuries had to be endured. Hardships experienced and fears had to be overcome. The Lord gives us fertile fields for growing food, but we must plant the crops. We have to guard them from the weeds and the pests. God's amazing processes indeed cause those seeds to germinate, causes the rains to fall and the plants to grow and the grain to ripen, but we have to go to the fields and harvest the results. We have to gather it, we have to winnow it, then we have to prepare it, either for storage or for immediate consumption. See, the principle is God has his part and we have our part. And that's the very definition of a relationship. Our part, however, is not to simply sit and watch as God does his part. Even at Jericho, when the walls of the city fell down by supernatural commandment, not because of a siege, Israel still was required to crawl over that rubble and put the inhabitants of Jericho to the sword. The inhabitants would have resisted. Israel did not come out unscathed from Jericho. Victory comes at a cost, even though the Lord has assured the victory. Obedience leads us to victory. Disobedience leads us to defeat. Either way, personal risks will be taken. Casualties will happen. To claim a victory does not only mean to sit and pray. It doesn't mean, as is too often practiced in the modern church, that we raise our hands and shout with assuredness, "Lord, we claim this victory over sickness." Or we claim this victory over evil, and that's the sum total of our effort. It begins and ends right there. Sitting and praying is the equivalent in Joshua of seeking the Lord's counsel. This is the necessary and obedient preliminary step. Asking God what to do and how to do it, that comes first. But after sitting and after praying and after he gives us his counsel, now it's time for us to get into the act. It's time for our action. And that action can mean life-threatening challenges. It can mean fearful or just uncomfortable encounters. It can mean opening our lives for change that may or may not meet our expectations. But why should we expect divine victory to be easy and painless in this fallen world? God's own Son went through hell in order to give us heaven. But in the end, it was all victory. Our difficult task is to see it as God sees it. Well, after chasing the remnants of those five defeated armies, the Israelites once again returned for some R&R. Now this time, though, verse 21 has the Israelite troops at Makkedah. Now some scholars find this to be in conflict with the statement just six verses earlier when it says the Israelite troops returned to their encampment at Gilgal. I think we're dealing with a tempest in a teapot here. It was normal then, just as it is now, to set up temporary bases as troops moved away from home location. Gilgal was home base. Makkedah was a temporary base for the troops and their involved in their current foray. The bulk of Israel probably remained in Gilgal. Those troops chosen to give chase to the enemy survivors had a remote base set up at Makkedah, where Joshua had decided to bivouac while waiting to deal with those five kings. Now, the end of verse 21 says that no one said a word against any of the people of Israel. What it literally says is, "But against any of the children of Israel shall not a dog whet his tongue." Now, I hope you recognize that's a Hebrew idiom. It has nothing to do with dogs and tongues. It's an idiom. It means that the returning troops didn't encounter any hostility on their way back, nor upon entering the Makkedah area. None of the friends and allies, we're told, essentially, dared to harass Israel. Now, and none of the residents of the city of Makkedah, the namesake and location of the cake where those five kings were now imprisoned, made any trouble for Israel. That's what we're being told. Well, the time of reckoning was at hand. Joshua orders those five kings to be brought out to him. I mean, what a regal parade that must have been. I mean, just imagine it. The kings of Jerusalem, Jebus at this time, Hebron, Yarmuth, Lachish, Eglon, all arrayed before Joshua, knowing what awaited them. First humiliation, then death. Joshua would use these kings to make a point. He called his young officers forward. He had the kings lay prostrate on the ground before Joshua, and then in turn, each of the army's commanders put their foot onto the necks these kings. I know that sounds a little barbaric, but it was not about stomping on these kings' backs or necks to cause injury. It was just a standard Middle Eastern symbol to indicate to everybody present just whom ruled over whom. For a common Israelite to put their foot on the neck of royalty, that was probably pretty intimidating for Joshua's troops. Kings were held high. They were greatly feared. It was commonly understood that they were more than human. You see, kings were thought to be connected to the gods, and some would become gods upon their death. But at the same time, it demonstrated to those who placed their foot on the neck of the kings and to all the younger officers who were present and watching that it was Israel, and by default Israel's God, who was superior, despite the title of king that these men bestowed upon themselves. In fact, Joshua needed to exhort his officers to come forward and engage in this symbolic gesture by telling them, don't be afraid, don't be confused, which means they were indeed kind of reluctant to come up and do this. Well, immediately thereafter, Joshua had the five kings executed and their bodies impaled on wooden poles. Now, even though most versions say they were hung on a tree, the hanging does not mean a rope around the neck. And the Hebrew word for tree and wood, you see, is the same. Etz. Rather, as was customary and pictured on several old Assyrian reliefs, this meant being killed and then their lifeless bodies hung on a pole. This act of impalement was, since time immemorial, an oriental symbolic gesture that meant the condemned person was also cursed. In fact, we see the Hebrews agree with and perfectly understand the meaning of being impaled, of being impaled on a tree, as indicating being cursed, which by definition means being cursed by a god. In Deuteronomy 21:22, if someone has committed a capital crime and is put to death, then hung on a tree, meaning being impaled, his body is not to remain all night on the tree, but you must bury him the same day, because a person who has been hanged has been cursed by God, so that you will not defile your land, which Adonai your God is giving you to inherit. So this law in Deuteronomy is also why we read in verse 27 of Joshua here, that at sunset, meaning the current day is coming to an end, the king's bodies are to be removed from their death stakes and then thrown back into that same cave where they'd been hiding. Now, this understanding about the correlation between being impaled on a pole or a tree, an etz, and then being cursed by God didn't change much over time. Listen to Paul in the book of Galatians, Galatians 3:13. The Messiah redeemed us from the curse pronounced in the Torah by becoming cursed on our behalf. For the Tanakh says, everyone who hangs from a stake comes under a curse. It didn't matter that the form of the wood that a condemned person hung from was shaped like a pole or a cross, or whether they were impaled through their bodies or impaled through their hands and their feet, like Yeshua. The tradition was that impalement on a wooden device indicated that God also had cursed that condemned person. Now, verse 28 explains that once the execution ceremony was completed, the Israelites attacked the city of Makkedah, where the Israelite army was currently bivouacked, and they killed its king. There were seven cities located in the general region of Makkedah: Makkedah proper, Libna, Lachish, Geser, Eglon, Hebron, and Debir. In turn, each of these cities was attacked. And various descriptions are given to exactly how each city was treated. Now, the long and the short of it is that the people were killed. The possessions and the livestock were taken as spoils of war for Israel. And as a result, a large portion of the southern half of the land of Canaan was now under Israeli control. Now, part of the reason that so much ink is being devoted to going through the treatment of each of these cities, one by one, explaining what happened, is to emphasize that Joshua and his men did exactly as they had been instructed by the Lord through Moses. Now, a quick reminder. The instructions had to do with the protocol God had established for holy war. And in holy war, all the spoils of war go to the Lord. And since it all belongs to him, he determined which of the spoils would remain as devoted to him and which the people of Israel could take for their own personal use. That which was devoted to the Lord became literally holy property. That which Israel could possess became desanctified, non-holy. Thus, it was safe for Israel to appropriate. Now, the first city that was taken by Israel, Jericho, was a special case because it was the first fruits of the property and the people of the land of Canaan. Therefore, the Lord kept everything from Jericho for himself. Keeping everything means, generally speaking, everything is deemed as holy property. Thus, it has to be destroyed or burned up. However, beginning with Ai, the second city taken, we see that only the structures and the enemy people were to be God's spoils of war. Pretty much everything else the Israelites could have for themselves. But the only way something could become God's and given to God for his exclusive use was for it to first be destroyed, and then usually burned up to ashes. So the point in the final 12 or 13 verses of Joshua 10 is to show that Israel had learned their lesson. They had understood that God meant what he said concerning the laws of holy war, the laws of harem. And so they scrupulously obeyed those laws in the conquering of southern Canaan. However, we're going to see a heavy implication in chapter 11 that Israel may not have destroyed and burned some of those southern cities. If that is the case, then they did not perfectly obey God despite their claims that they did. But apparently they did it well enough that the Lord did not punish them for their imperfections. Now verses 40 to 43 offers us a summation of the southern attack. It outlines the area that was affected by Israel. It was from Kadesh Barnea to the city of Gaza. Yep. That same Gaza that we know of in the news today. And then it was on east to Gibeon. It also speaks of the land of Goshen. This is not the same land of Goshen that Israel lived in while they were in Egypt. It's just named the same. It's a common occurrence to use a name over and over again. Now, there's a lot of disagreement on the location of these ancient cities, so where you see them on maps that I've been showing you are just approximations. Well, the chapter ends with Joshua and his fighting men returning to their main encampment at Gilgal, where the tabernacle is set up, the sanctuary rituals begin, sacrifices, services of the high priest, common priests, and Levites are going to go on with these rituals for many decades there at Gilgal. Well, Gilgal then is the original semi-permanent location for the wilderness tabernacle in the land of Canaan. Many years later, it would move, and for many more years, it would reside in Shiloh. What's important to grasp is that wherever the sanctuary of God was resting, there was the most important place in the Holy Lands for the people of Israel. There is where they all went for their pilgrimage festivals. There is where they went to present their sacrifices. There is where they took their firstborn sons to redeem them. When God called for a holy convocation for Israel, for decades and decades after crossing the Jordan, that place they went was Gilgal. It would be around three more centuries before Jerusalem would finally take on that special holy status by moving the priesthood and the sanctuary there to Mount Moriah. Well, let's move on to Joshua chapter 11. Open your Bibles to Joshua chapter 11, page 253. We're going to read the whole chapter. When Yavin, king of Hatzor, heard of it, he informed Yovav, king of Madon, the king of Shimron, the king of Akshaph, the kings to the north in the hills, in the Arabah south of the Kinneroth, and in the Shephelah, and in the regions of Dor on the west, the Canaanites to east and west, the Amorites, Hittites, Perizzites, Jebusites in the hills, and the Hivites at the foot of Mount Hermon in the land of Mizpah. So they set out, they and all of their armies, many people, in numbers like the sand at the seashore, with very many horses and chariots. And all these kings met together, and they came and pitched camp together at the Merom spring in order to fight Israel. Adonai said to Joshua, "Don't be afraid on their account, because at this time tomorrow I will hand them over, all of them dead, before Israel. You are to hamstring their horses and burn up their chariots." So Joshua came against them suddenly with all his fighting men and fell on them at Merom Spring. Adonai handed them over to Israel. They attacked, they chased them to Greater Sidon, Misrephot Maim, and eastward to the Mizpah Valley. They attacked them until none of them was left. Joshua did to them what Adonai had ordered. He hamstrung their horses, burned up their chariots. Then Joshua turned back, and he captured Hatzor, striking its king dead with the sword. For in times past, Hatzor had been the head of all of those kingdoms. They put everyone there to death with the sword, completely destroying them. There was nothing left that breathed, and he burned Hatzor to the ground. Joshua captured all the cities of those kings and the kings as well. He defeated them with the sword, completely destroyed them, as Moses, the servant of Adonai, had ordered. But as for the cities built on their tells, Israel burned none of them except for Hatzor. Joshua did burn that one. All the spoils of these cities and the livestock the people of Israel took as booty for themselves. But every human being they put to death with the sword until they had destroyed them. They left no one breathing. Moses had given orders to Joshua, just as Adonai had given orders to Moses, his servant, and Joshua acted accordingly. He did everything Adonai had ordered Moses. So Joshua captured all that land, the hills, the Negev, all the land of Goshen, the Shephelah, the Arabah, and all the Israeli hills and Shephelah, from the bare mountain that goes up to Seir to Baal Gad in the Lebanon Valley under Mount Hermon. And he took all their kings, and he struck them and put them to death. And Joshua made war with all those kings for a long time. Not one city made peace with the people of Israel, except for the Hivites living in Gibeon. They took everything in battle. For it was Adonai who caused them to harden their hearts and come against Israel in battle, so that they would be utterly destroyed, so that they would not find favor but be destroyed in keeping with the orders Adonai had given Moses. Joshua at that time came and cut off the Anakim from the land, from Hebron, Debir, Anav, and from all the hill country of Judah and Israel. Joshua utterly destroyed them and their cities. No Anakim were left in the land of the people of Israel. Only in Gaza, Gat, and Ashdod did some remain. Joshua took the whole land in keeping with all that Adonai had said to Moses and to Israel according to their divisions into tribes. Then the land rested from war. Just as chapter 10 was the historical and the theological story of the conquering of southern Canaan, Joshua chapter 11 is the story of the conquering of the northern areas of the land of Canaan. Now, as is obvious by the reading, chapters 10 and 11 form one unit. The chapter division between the two probably shouldn't be there at all from a literary and historical viewpoint. Now, further, we see both a historical and theological pattern develop between these two chapters. Historically, we see a northern coalition of kings and their city-states form to try and thwart the invading Israelite army from overtaking their many kingdoms, mimicking what had happened in the south. And theologically, we see the pattern of God instructing Joshua and promising him victory. Joshua obeys, he instructs Israel, Israel obeys, so victory is achieved by means of battle. The chapter begins with the king of Hazor receiving intelligence of what had happened in the south, of the stunning defeat of this five-army coalition, the destruction of so many major Canaanite cities and their inhabitants by the Israeli forces. So the king of Hazor forms an alliance with the kings of Madon, Shimron, Akshaph, and other kings of northern Canaan. This is a military alliance. Its purpose is to attack Israel before they can gain a foothold in the northern territories. Now, it's interesting to me that in the recently completed southern campaign, now up in the north of Canaan, it was the Canaanites who ignited the battles. They had heard of Israel's intentions. They believed it thoroughly. So they responded with a preemptive strike. The question this raises is, why did Joshua, or was it God, wait for the enemy to strike Israel's forces before they carried out the Lord's standing order to take Canaan for its inheritance? I'm not sure there's a good theological answer to this, but there's a good human behavioral answer. Israel's army and its leaders were reluctant. They were in no hurry to subject themselves to war and to all the accompanying hardships and injury and death. Likely a great deal of procrastination on Israel's part would have led to the Canaanite forces more thoroughly readying themselves, making it all the more difficult to rout them out of their strongholds. And the Lord knew Israel pretty well. Further, it was really in Israel's best interests the response of these various major city-states in Canaan was to band together. Then they would leave the relative safety and security of their fortresses to engage Israel out in the open. They would make themselves more vulnerable. It kind of validates the old cliche of providing an opportunity for Israel to kill as many birds as they can with one stone. If these various kings from all over Canaan had decided on a strategy of relying on the impenetrability of the high and the thick walls and the strong defensive positions, usually these walled cities were on elevated land and hilltops, of their capital cities, this war of conquest could have gone on a lot longer than it did, because each and every city would have required a lengthy siege by Israel to take it. So much like as the Lord dealt with Egypt's Pharaoh, he put a hardness in the hearts of these Canaanite kings and a foolhardy arrogance in their minds. And God literally drew them out of their barricaded strongholds into a place where he could have them slain in just one major stroke. The point being that not only was there a supernatural influence exerted by Jehovah upon Joshua and the army of God, but it was also upon the enemy. This is another pattern that emerges from the Tanakh, the Old Testament that never changes. Watch as the Lord uses this exact device of pulling mighty armies foolishly, arrogantly, away from their home bases, away from their strongholds, so that they may be destroyed in one decisive battle. We'll finish up today by reading Ezekiel 38. Open your Bibles to Ezekiel 38. What a great story this is. Ezekiel 38 on page 692 if you have a complete Jewish Bible. We're actually going to go about five verses into 39, and that's going to end our day. The word of Adonai came to me. Human being, turn your face towards Gog in the land of Magog, chief prince of Meshech and Tubal. Prophesy against him. Say that Adonai Elohim says, I am against you, Gog, chief prince of Meshech and Tubal. I will turn you around. I'll put hooks in your jaws and bring you out with all of your army, your horses, your horsemen, all completely equipped, a great horde with breastplates and shields, all wielding swords. Paros, Ethiopia, and Put are with them, all with breastplates and helmets. Gomer, with all its troops, the house of Togarmah in the far reaches of the north, with all of its troops. Many peoples are with you. Prepare yourself, get ready, you and all your crowd gathered around you, and take charge of them. After many days have passed, you will be mustered for service. In later years, you will invade the land which has been brought back from the sword, gathered out of many peoples, the mountains of Israel. They have been lying in ruins for a long time, but now Israel has been extracted from the peoples, and all of them are living there securely. You will come up like a storm. You will be like a cloud covering the land, you and all your troops and many other peoples with you. Adonai Elohim says, when that day comes, thoughts will well up in your mind, and you will devise a sinister scheme. You will say, I'm going to invade this land of unwalled villages. I will take by surprise these people who are at peace, living securely, all in places without walls or bars or gates. I will seize the spoil and take the plunder. You will attack the former ruins that are now inhabited and come against the people gathered from the nations who have acquired livestock and other wealth and are living in the central parts of the land. Sheva, Dedan, all the leading merchants of Tarshish will ask you, have you come to seize spoil? Have you assembled your hordes to loot, to carry off silver, gold, livestock, and other wealth, to take much plunder? Therefore, human being, prophesy, tell Gog, that Adonai Elohim says this, won't you be aware of it when my people Israel are living in security? You will choose just that time to come from your place in the far reaches of the north, you and your many peoples with you, all of them on horseback, a huge horde, a mighty army, and you will invade my people Israel like a cloud covering the land. This will be in the Achalit HaYamim, and I will bring you against my land so that the Gentiles will know me when before their eyes I set apart as holy through you, Gog. Adonai Elohim says, I spoke of you long ago through my servants, the prophets of Israel, and back then they prophesied for many years that I would have you invade them. And when that day comes, when Gog invades the land of Israel, says Adonai Elohim, my furious anger will boil up. And in my jealousy, in my heated fury, I speak. When that day comes, there will be a great earthquake in the land of Israel, so that the fish in the sea, the birds in the air, the wild beasts, all the reptiles creeping on the ground, every human being there in the land will tremble before me. Mountains will fall. Cliffs will crumble. Every wall will crash to the ground. I will summon a sword against him throughout all my mountains, says Adonai Elohim. Every man will wield his sword against his brother. I will judge him with plague and with blood. I will cause torrential rain to fall on him, his troops, and the many peoples with him, along with huge hailstones, fire, and sulfur. I will show my greatness and holiness, making myself known in the sight of many nations. Then they will know that I am Adonai. The Lord will draw the enemies of Israel out into the open. There they will be destroyed, just like the conquest of Canaan And we'll continue with Joshua chapter 11 next time.
Help support God's people by purchasing items made by them. Merchandise with a meaning. Products with a purpose. HolyLandMarketplace.com. For more teachings, visit, support, or donate at TorahClass.com. Join with us in worship and enjoy God's Word at Seat of Abraham Fellowship.